This Week in Retronauts, it's one giant leap for Robot Kind. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts episode 475, according to my notes. Don't press charges or accuse me of bad things if I am mistaken. If this does not sync up with a number on the cover art, this is just plans. We are, you know, the best plans may go awry, but what will not go awry is this episode, which is going to be a long overdue conversation about one of the greatest early PlayStation games ever published. Courtesy of a patron request. Patron, please introduce yourself and tell us why you demanded that we talk about this topic.
Hello, my name is Scott, a loyal taxpaying citizen of Universal City Hall. Jumping Flash, it's one of these games that has just like always been around. Like, it's always in all these like PlayStation collections and republishers and like republications and stuff, but I feel like no one ever really talks about it. And it's a game that I had a lot of experience with as a child. So I was always like, yeah, Jumping Flash. Everyone loves Jumping Flash. And then it was just like, no one talks about Jumping Flash. Why don't people talk about Jumping Flash? So yeah, let's talk about it.
It's one of those series that I feel, you know, kind of made a splash in the early days of PlayStation, but then they kind of let it fizzle out. And, you know, we missed out on a lot of the sequels and spinoffs. So eventually at some point, it seems like the developer was absorbed into Sony Game Studio or Sony Japan Studio, and now Sony Japan Studio no longer exists. So that probably about wraps it up for Jumping Flash. But the games still play really well. I think they hold up extremely well. I mean, I didn't discover Jumping Flash myself until, I don't know, like 1999 or so. It was pretty late, but I was very impressed by what I discovered. Anyway, I don't think I mentioned, maybe I did, I'm Jeremy Parrish. And Scott, you're not the only person here to talk about Jumping Flash with us. We also have an expert, I think, on Sony Japan Studio type games, or at least someone who talks about them a lot. Who are you? Introduce yourself, returning to Retronauts.
Oh, hello there. My name is Todd Selick. I'm a big fan of developers like Exact, and I was pleased to find that, unlike a real rabbit, Robot does not eat his own poop.
Oh, that's fantastic. Does he even poop, actually?
Good question. Maybe we're going to find out today.
That is not in my notes, but if someone has anything to add, then go for it. So Jumping Flash, like I said, early PlayStation game, one of the first, I think, you know, kind of standout titles for PlayStation. I mean, everyone oohed and awed over Ridge Racer and Toshinden, we learned better later. But, you know, in the early days, those were kind of the graphical showcases. But this was sort of the game. Oh, and Wipeout, of course. But this was kind of the game that maybe it wasn't as graphically impressive as those, but I feel like it really showed off the potential of 3D action games, what you could do in 3D that you could not do in a traditional 2D game. And it arrived, you know, a couple of years before Mario 64. So until Mario 64 arrived, and, you know, we got around the same time, Crash Bandicoot and Knights, this was pretty much the standard. And I kind of feel like Jumping Flash, you know, if you draw a triangle of Knights, Into Dreams, and Super Mario 64 and Crash Bandicoot, Jumping Flash is right there in the middle of all of those. It kind of does a lot of the things each of those games does, and it has its own distinct personality. And as such, I feel like it's really memorable. And as Scott mentioned, it shows up on a lot of collections. It's been on, not Virtual Console, PlayStation Network, PS1 Classics. I think it was on the PlayStation 1 Mini that no one bought because it was terrible. It was probably the PAL ROM, and it ran at like 10 frames a second. But Sony, you know, republishes it a lot. They just haven't done anything with the property since, what, 2000? 1999? 2000? It's been a long time. It's 20 years. It's overdue. But they seem to kind of let those properties, the ones we love so much, like Gravity Rush, just kind of languish. Oh, well.
Oh, yes.
Todd, what was your... Scott mentioned that he played Jumping Flash a lot as a kid. I mentioned that I discovered it late. Where do you fall into this picture as a Jumping Flash aficionado?
Well, I first played it on a demo station. You know, they had them when the PlayStation first came out, they had, you know, little stations set up in places like Media Play where you could play Twisted Metal and all these other games. And I remember playing Jumping Flash and not really understanding what I was doing because, you know, I didn't have any instructions or anything, but I was able to grasp that it was a 3D platformer. And over the years, I would go back to Jumping Flash a few times. Every time I did, though, I would kind of not really give it a fair shake. I would really, I think what the fact that it was a 3D platformer where I couldn't really see my character made me a little biased against it. And I think that in the early days of the PlayStation, I was also kind of a little, maybe even bitter that all these 3D games were taking attention away from 2D games. So I maybe didn't give it quite the respect it deserves, but just a few years ago, I basically was going back to it again. And by this point, I'd played a bunch of Gravity Rush and Gravity Rush 2. And in Gravity Rush 2, there's a power-up called the Lunar Style that makes the character, main character Cat, a little more floaty, and she can jump really high. And after I played that and went back to Jumping Flash, something just clicked. And I was like, whoa, this is like Gravity Rush, and this is actually really impressive.
I'm not surprised to learn that Gravity Rush was your gateway into this game, since you were on the Gravity Rush episode. What was that? Earlier this year? Last year?
It's been a while. Last year, anyway, I think.
Yeah. Yep. But yeah, like I didn't discover Jumping Flash until several years, like 5 years after it debuted. But I think if I had discovered it, you know, played it, demoed it back when it was new, I think I would have been in the same boat as you. I think I would have said, this is too abstract. You don't see your character. It's kind of like a first-person shooter, but it's not. And it's different. And I don't think I would have liked it. There wasn't anything for me to kind of anchor myself to. But, you know, for whatever reason, going back to it several years later, it just clicked with me immediately. And I said, oh, this is really great. I love the style. It's, you know, simple, accessible, but it's just different, and no one's done anything like this. And to this day, no one's really done anything like this. Only Exact has, really.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, I see some modern equivalents. I mean, so, like, with first-person platformers, and I think of other games where I've done a lot of, like, first-person platforming, even in that era and a little bit later, and a lot of games like Half-Life and like Turok and all of those come to mind, and how just miserable it is trying to like keep place of where your character is and moving at the same time. And then going back to Jumping Flash, and I know it's obviously like way more focused on platforming, but how much of a better job a game way earlier, even back to the predecessor Geograph Seal, like does with being able to move your character around in the air and precisely land where you want to, compared to lots of games that would come later that, you know, just running off cliffs trying to jump from platform to platform.
Yeah, I struggled with Dark Forces. I forced my way through some of the jumping sections in that game because it was so good otherwise. And then I got to Turok on N64. That was one of the first games I bought for N64. And I got to the part where there's just like these little, you know, like stone spires that you have to jump across, and you can't tell what you're doing. You can't tell you where you're landing, how you are positioned relative to other objects in space. And it's miserable. And I said at that moment, I am not going to play a first person shooter about jumping. But then Jumping Flash came along, and then Metroid Prime came along, and the developers actually said, you know, those kids at Exact, they get it. So the Texans got it right, but everyone else bungles it. Jumping in first-person games really sucks, but not in Jumping Flash, because it understands that video games should be fun, and that part of a video game being fun is that you need to be able to grasp what you're doing and have a sense of, you know, your relationship to the environment and everything around you. And that's something that is, you know, a lesson that people just didn't take. They should have paid more attention, but they didn't, and it's very sad. But we still have Jumping Flash to inspire us. So I do want to start out by talking a little bit about the developer behind this game, Exact. There's also a credit in some sources, including Wikipedia, to a developer called Ultra that I've never heard of. And trying to look up Ultra as a developer, it's even harder than looking up Exact as a developer, because there's Ultra Games, you know? There was Ultra 64. There was, like, who the hell are they? I don't know. But the ones we really care about are Exact, because they have the kind of legacy. And I haven't found any, like, studio exposés on Exact. I can't find any interviews about, you know, like, with the staff or anything like that. So, you know, all we can really do is look at something like Moby Games at the different staff members on Jumping Flash. And basically, all of them have no credits prior to Exact. So I feel like this was one of those instances where a studio was founded by a bunch of amateurs who said, let's make video games together. You know, they graduated from high school, took their allowances, their graduation money, and founded a studio. And they made computer games because, you know, there was a pretty big hobbyist amateur market in Japan for PCs. And eventually, I guess that got them noticed by Sony, and they made a game for the PlayStation early on.
Yeah, it is difficult to come up with information on them. I mean, a lot of places, you know, some of it's unsourced. It was basically just a group of four designers and developers who got together to form the company. I did pick up on Moby Games. One of the designers on Jumping Flash, looks like they may have worked on one of the Valis games, which doesn't surprise me too much, because Telenet had, you know, was the sort of start of a lot of careers. But you are right about it is being difficult to find a lot of information on that. What I find interesting is, though, that they chose to start their career as Exact on the X 68000. Mm-hmm. I mean, was that something that a Japanese developer would normally do? Or would they be more likely to choose a console like the PC Engine or even the MXX?
No, I mean, if you look at their earliest games, which you found one called Nias from 1990.
Yeah, it looks like that was their first one, yeah.
Okay, yeah, like by 1990, the MSX was not a consideration. I mean, the only thing you got at that point on MSX was Metal Gear 2, and that was, you know, because Konami was entrenched on MSX. Like, they you know, rode that out to the very end. But otherwise, yeah, the MSX was winding down. And I think the barrier to entry for PCs was pretty mild, you know, compared to consoles. You know, if you look at PC 98, even more so than X68000, you have a huge sort of almost like a bedroom development scene, you know, kind of similar to what you had in the UK throughout the 90s, but, you know, much more focused on visual novels, pornography, arcade style games. And yeah, so to me, it makes perfect sense that they would have started on a PC. I would have expected, you know, PC 98, but X68000, you know, if you're serious about video games, that's the one you want to go to, because that was basically like the X68000. Sharp basically said, hey, let's take a Capcom CPS-1 cabinet and stick it into a computer box. And it was an amazing machine for video games. And, it was viable, you know, into the mid 90s, I would say, with games like Castlevania. You know, Konami supported that one a lot too. Namco. There were lots and lots of great games, some, you know, from very well-known publishers, but also some from smaller publishers like this. So yeah, like, I feel like X68000 was kind of the midpoint for a starting developer, like an accessible platform where you didn't have to, you know, pay licensing fees and have, you know, minimum manufacturing guarantees and things like that, as you would for a closed console. But at the same time, it was capable of delivering a very, very arcade style, like, you know, powered experience. So, yeah, like it works. I see it. I get it. I grok it.
All right. Now, was it at the time actually one of the most, if not, or maybe the most powerful home computer you could really get in Japan?
Yeah, I mean, the X68000 is a beast. It's an amazing computer. I can't wait.
It's hours of power.
I can't wait until either I get the one that I was sent up and running properly, or they get the Cores and Mister running properly. Either way, it's going to be amazing, because there's just so much to be tapped in the X68000. And, you know, games like Exax are some of them. Like, all of these games look great. I don't know how well they necessarily play. I haven't been able to play any of them. I think the two of you can speak more to that. But, yeah, like, to me, this is just very emblematic of the sort of bootstrap development that you saw in Japan toward the end of the 80s, early 90s. And the cream rises to the top, basically, and they made good enough stuff that eventually Sony was like, you are making a PS1 game, or two, or three, or four.
Oh, yeah.
So do you guys want to talk about Nias Aquales Etoile Princess and Geograph Seal? I guess we can talk about that one separately, but yeah, anything you can talk about these?
Well, it seems like Exact started off like a lot of the smaller Japanese developers of the early 1990s did, because it was kind of like a kid in grade school trying out all these extracurricular activities and sports just to find out what they were good at. And So they basically tried out all these popular genres. And Nias is basically a bog standard horizontal spaceship shooter, very similar to Thunder Force and Gate of Thunder and Raze Amber and about a dozen other games that came out around the same time. It feels like a lot of the Genesis shooters that we had in America. And I think that if this one had actually had a Mega Drive or Genesis version, it would have been out in America, just like all games like Whip Rush and Soul Feast and everything. And there's not too much in it that really shows Exact's ambitions, apart from the fact that, you know, they don't really stick to one plane. It's mostly horizontal, but every now and then your ship will have to move upwards and dodge things. And in between the levels, they give you this little primitive 3D graphics display with, you know, wireframe, just telling you what's going on in really, really awkward English. But yeah, it's really basically just the first game for our studio trying to figure out what they can do. And it wouldn't be surprise me if it's kind of started out as a tech demo, maybe just as a learning experience for them. And that's about all there really is to say about Nias.
All right. And have you played Aquales that came out the following year?
Yeah, that was that's kind of my kind of game, because it's, you know, a mecha shooter with a lot of anime overtones.
And yeah, it's very Metal Warriors looking, or Cybernator. Right.
Yeah, so the whole assault suits thing. But it does seem to be kind of part of that school of games from the early 90s, where the developers were more concerned with evoking a giant mecha anime feel. And to that end, they made the robot way too big on the screen. Mm-hmm. There's some other games that are like that, like Browning and Vegas Tactical Gladiator. And this one, I mean, they're clearly apt to do the mecha anime thing, because the intro itself needs almost an entire separate disc, I think. And the one thing that sets it apart, though, is that you have a grappling hook or a grappling weapon, and you can use that to scale buildings. So they, again, you know, Exact is not, they're not really sticking to one plane of movement. They're letting you go up and all over. And it's not really a great game. It just feels kind of clumsy, because you're half the time. Yeah.
It feels almost like Japan's version of a European platformer from the era, where we have a really big character and these kind of, you know, the quote unquote airplane hangar stages, where it's just like it goes in all directions and you have to kind of find your way around, and you're going up and down, scrolling, you know, basically in every direction, and things are hitting you from off screen that you don't have time to react to. And it's not necessarily all that fun, but it does look really cool. And, you know, like, I can definitely draw a through line from this to their Ghost in the Shell game, where you're controlling a mecha and it's very much about vertical movement and scaling and, you know, approaching things from alternate angles. But, you know, this is kind of like Votoms, the video game, as opposed to Ghost in the Shell, the video game. So it feels like it's something from an earlier era.
Yeah, it almost reminded me of, which was, you know, came after this, but Gasaraki, the anime, where the robots have grappling hooks, but it's otherwise kind of very realistic in the tone. And what you see, it's almost like realistically bulky. Like, maybe they even wanted that to be part of it. Like, you're piloting this giant mech, so of course it's going to be a little awkward and something. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really work out in a game, though.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Pat Labor is fun to watch because everything is so kind of cumbersome, but that doesn't necessarily translate into great video gaming.
Is it like a Bionic Commando grappling hook, or is it like...
It doesn't really have that sense of physics. Sorry.
Yeah, no. It's more simplistic. Oh, it's okay. It's kind of like... It kind of reminds me a little bit... I mean, it's more involved than the one in Contra 4, but not by much. Like, in addition to just going straight up, you can also swing a little bit, but it's a really short grappling hook, so it just kind of gives you some extra momentum. Like, this is definitely not
Umihara Kawase
or something. Yeah. it's much simpler. It kind of reminds me of Super Metroid's grappling beam.
Oh, sure.
In that it's kind of clumsy and slow, and you use it for traversal, but you kind of don't want to. I mean, this is all just, you know, from watching YouTube videos, not actually playing the game. But I look at this and I think, wow, I don't want to grapple in this game. It just doesn't seem fun.
Yeah, my Super Metroid grappling is usually like swing and then a panicked like straight up shot to like grab it and be like, all right, okay, I'm good. Yep. And then like swing again and then straight up like, all right.
Yep. That seems like this kind of thing. Yeah, for sure. But, you know, like they're trying. They're doing some cool stuff here. And then their next game before Geograph Seal, their final game before Geograph Seal, and the jumping flash movement, was called Etoile Princess, which, like, watching videos of this, I got major Magic Knight Ray Earth for Saturn vibes from it.
Yeah, it does.
Although
have
it predates
same.
Ray Earth by a couple of years.
Yeah, it definitely has that same kind of feel because of just the way the characters look. They're just very, these large-headed characters on the screen. And
there's a redhead who shoots like magic beams, and then there's, you know, a more mousy-looking girl who shoots wind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does this studio have some French connection? They seem to just keep... There's, like, at least three of their titles. Seemingly.
That's just a thing. Like, there's a bunch of... you find a lot of French names and affectations in Japanese games like from this era.
Maybe one of the designers took French in high school or something. You know, it's sometimes it's just that is. But, you know, this also kind of reminds me of Namco's The Legend of Valkyrie games because you can jump around freely and shoot things. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty decent little action RPG. It doesn't really have a lot in common with Jumping Flash, though. I mean, if you showed me this and told me it was made by the Jumping Flash team, I wouldn't see too many connections apart from some of the goofier character designs.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, in terms of gameplay, it's almost like a single player Pocky and Rocky that isn't a linear shooter. It's more open, very colorful. It has tons of animated interstitials with you know, big-headed characters with huge eyes doing their yammering thing and looking angry. And, you know, the jointed fist comes up slowly to shake in anger. You know, it's just that kind of stuff. It's very, very much of its time, but appealing for that sense because, you know, it is like very much a time capsule.
Right. It actually does have I'm surprised that it had so many playable characters. I think you rescue a new character at the end of each stage. And there's like eight or something that you can.
Are they all playable?
I think so. There's a bunch that you can bring in. You can only pick three per level. So again, that's the Ray Earth angle. But yeah, it does have a lot of characters that you can play as.
Okay, I didn't realize all those characters that you rescue. I saw that you rescue characters, but I didn't realize all of them are playable because the video that I watched just showed three different characters in action over the course of the entire thing. So there was like a guy who could shoot like a blade beam or something, kind of like a blue laser beam that kind of looked like a sword. Anyway, it seems like the kind of thing I would have enjoyed playing for a few hours in the 90s. It doesn't seem like the kind of game that has more than a few hours of gameplay. So just a little bit of fluff, but appealing, like visual appealing. And then we come to 1994, March 1994, and Geograph Steel, a game that has nothing whatsoever in common with Etoile Princess. It's basically they looked at Star Fox and said, we should do like ground-based shooting in a free roaming space with this, which also at the same time Argonaut was doing with Star Fox 2. And my theory is that Nintendo looked at Geograph Seal and said, oh God, they just beat us at our own game. We got to can this game and just move on to N64. That's my theory and I'm sticking to it.
Nintendo had the benefit of having a controller with more than two buttons for their game.
That's true.
I will say Geograph Seal does an impressive amount with a two-button control scheme. It's takes a little bit of getting used to, but once you kind of figure out how it works, you're like flying through the air, bouncing off enemies, switching up your weapons mid-flight, and just like raining mayhem down on stuff. And it actually gets pretty fun, but it definitely is very limited by the hardware. So I was able to play it through emulation, and then was able to basically bump it up to, I think, like the next version of like the version of the X68000 that came next. I think it had like twice the clock speed or something like that.
Yeah, there were a few different versions or a few different models of the X68000. I think the Type 14 is what it's called, had not just a faster clock speed, but also a lot more RAM. And I think you could get RAM expansions. So I feel like if you had, you know, the top of the line machine, which probably costs like $5,000 in 1990s money, you know, crazy expensive, but it would have been a pretty satisfying experience.
Yeah. With the upped clock speed, it was definitely fun. It does drag, for sure. I mean, once you've kind of done like the first level of combat, you've kind of like done all of the levels of combat, except for the random like flight level that they throw in there every so often. That's like an on rails, like closer to Star Fox, level. But for the most part, it's just like you're bouncing off stuff, but it gets like really fun until you realize that the stuff that you're having fun isn't actually the stuff that's progressing you through the level, because there's supposed to be these targets that like you're hunting for, but they're kind of hard to find and obscured by lots of enemies that you just want to like bounce off of and blow up, but they just infinitely respawn. So you're kind of just not making progress until you realize you need to hunt this stuff down. And the stuff is not very easy to hunt down with all of the mess that's going on with all the polygons. So
I was actually really impressed by how playable the game is, because when I looked up in screenshots and videos, I was expecting something similar to early 3D games on the Jaguar or the 32X or something. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this is actually very approachable. And if you can put up with the slower or the slowdown, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I feel like this is really putting the X68000 to uses that it was never intended for. Like it's kind of like the Sega Saturn in that it is this amazing powerhouse for creating 2D graphics, bitmap graphics. And here's a game that is all, you know, it's polygons, but it's not a system designed to push polygons. So I feel like it's doing the thing where it creates a lot of triangles and kind of fakes it all together, but it fakes it very impressively. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, it's very Star Fox like, but it has a faster frame rate, more visual detail. I mean, you look at things like the HUD elements and the projectiles and the arrow designs, like pointing at targets, and you're like, wow, this team really liked Star Fox. But you know, it only has a few, as Scott said, Star Fox style stages, and it feels much more like the all range ground combat in Star Fox 2. But I think personally, to me, it looks better. I haven't, again, played it because X68000, but it just seems like you have a lot more lateral movement, a lot more freedom. I mean, the fact that it is such a vertical game and gives you this triple jump, and you know, we talked about the camera panning to help you land more effectively. That debuts here. It's not as effective as in Jumping Flash, but it starts here. And they were clearly thinking about the problems of how to navigate 3D space in this kind of game.
In this one, the jumping is actually, to me, more helpful for combat and stuff, because you can get out of the like flight of like a lot of the enemy's weapons, and as it tilts down, you can just shoot down on stuff, typically things that can't shoot back up at you. I mean, we'll get to it more once we talk about Jumping Flash. But to me, like, this engine to me is most fun. The movement of it is really what is fun and what excels, and less so like the focus on the combat, which is what I think this game gets stuck too much in, is trying to be like Star Fox and being very combat focused. When I think they have actually something different and more fun. Well, not more fun, but fun in a different way. That they're kind of like, that they'll figure out, I guess, soon enough.
And this probably helped the exact get their foot in the door with Sony too, because I mean, if they saw what they could do on, you know, a computer that wasn't really designed for extensive 3D, they probably want them working on a PlayStation game.
Yeah, there's no hardware accelerator. on X68000. No expansions beyond like the RAM and the faster clock speed for some models. So they're working with stock hardware, unlike, you know, Star Fox or like Quake or something. I guess this predates Quake by a few years. Actually, this is the same year as Doom, huh? 1993? No, 94. Okay. So it's like 3-4 months after Doom came out on the FTP server, you know, the stealth launch. So this is very much of its time. I mean, you know, this is doing the first person thing, but instead of being, you know, Doom fakes the y-axis. It's really a 2D game that is extremely good at faking being in a third dimension, like having a third dimension to it and being in a 3D space. But, you know, when you aim at something that is on a higher level than you, you can't miss it because your gun is like shooting a projectile across a 2D plane, and then visually it's just like skewed. So it goes up and hits the cyber demon on the ledge or whatever.
Yeah, you can play the whole game from that map. It's the same experience, that like that 2D map thing.
Yeah, but here you have Exact doing the first person shooter, but also putting genuine verticality into it. Not just like, hey, you can aim up and down, but you can jump high, high, high into the air. And it's like Kirk versus Khan, you know, two-dimensional thinking, Captain. Doom, you know, it has the impressive abs, but Geograph Seal is smarter and ultimately wins the day. Anyway, so from here, we jump ahead one year and a month, which is a pretty impressive turnaround time, really. But Exact says farewell to the X68000 and puts its chips all in on PlayStation. And you have to imagine this was incredibly liberating for them. They're a company that really wanted to do cool 3D stuff, and they were faking it so well on X68000, and now here they are working directly with Sony on a system that could do more triangles faster and better than anyone else at the time. That has to be a huge upgrade, just, you know, quality of life. And so they gave us Jumping Flash, and it's a heck of a game. It's you know, if Geograph Seal is a first-person shooter with platforming elements, this is a platformer with first-person shooting elements, which is a fine distinction, but I think an important one, because it is a game that's just about like the boundless freedom of leaping around in 3D and soaring across these huge gulfs and jumping to far distant places. You know, like they said when they were pitching Destiny and lying to us, if you can see it, you can go there. But in Jumping Flash, by God, that's true, because your Robit, your mech can jump in the air multiple times with his little rocket-powered feet, and he jumps so high and triple jumps and then descends slowly. It's phenomenal. Just such a good-feeling game.
Yeah, it's the controls take a little bit of getting used to at first, and sort of how you can control Robit in the air with, like, holding down X and letting it go so that you're, you know, you can change between pivoting and sort of strafing. And when you first start out, the controls feel very sort of like restrictive at first. You know, you're trying to like rotate on the ground and like look around and stuff as you would sort of other games of that. And if you try to play like that, you're going to get frustrated.
It's a bad experience, yeah.
Yeah. But you quickly learn that, like, oh, if I move backwards when I'm turning, you actually turn a lot faster. And same with moving forwards. And so you get in this kind of like always moving, and I don't want to be on the ground, I want to be in the air. And like you said, just everything is basically like a platform or something for you to interact with. Like, you're just bouncing off enemies, bouncing off clouds, jumping on these just like fantastical environments, all just trying to collect, carrots, but jetpacks, rocket packs, whatever. They're carrots. there's just so much stuff to interact with, and a lot of the times you don't quite know what is going to happen. You're picking up all these special weapons that aren't really spelled out to you what you're going to do, and you like try them, and sometimes they're worthless, and sometimes rockets fly out in 20 different directions, and time stops, and it's just like crazy mayhem and bright colors and a delight. It's so much fun.
And what I was really impressed with when I went back to revisit the game is how much personality it has for a game that's made almost entirely of early 3D. I mean, and early 3D games struggled to, evoke that same cartoonish appeal that 2D games could. And something like Star Fox, it cheats a little by having the pilots talking to each other. But what Jumping Flash does outside of the cutscenes, it does almost entirely with polygons and, 1995 polygons as well. But you have really nice music. You have all these little animals capering around, and you don't really see Robert too much. But when you end the stage, you've got him sitting there, and with his little celebrating or whatever. So even that's kind of neat.
You do get a bit of his personality from like the view inside of like the like ornaments and like UI and stuff like moving around a little as you react in your AI buddy that. Everyone seems to hate this AI. I found it like kind of funny and charming, but I don't know. People seem to really find the AI companion a bit grating from my reading. But yeah, you get like this bit of personality of like it's almost like an actual cockpit view of like this rabbit machine.
So I guess Robert isn't a self-motivated robot, but a mech.
I was curious about that. Is there supposed to be someone piloting him? I don't think so, but
I don't think, no, it says that he was built and like, I think he has his own agency because of the third game. He's like, he goes like, becomes a mercenary. so I assume Robert has some sort of agency, but it's weird because it has its own agency, but you get like a cockpit view as if someone was riding. Pilot.
I can see why they gave Exact Ghost in the Shell, because you have the Fuchikomas or Tachikomas, which are kind of sentient, but also they're controlled by like mental connections by people. Yeah. So anyway, so just to explain what Jumping Flash is, it is basically a 3D platformer, but it's played through a first person view, which is very unusual. You don't see a lot of first person action games with a high emphasis on jumping and verticality, and usually it's terrible. But this is very different. This kind of gives you the Doom perspective. There are even some stages that play much more like Doom or maybe more like Faceball 2000. But you're not seeing the character at all times. You're navigating from a first person perspective, and it's a little disorienting at first, but you are basically traveling around, 18 different stages, I think, 6 worlds with 3 levels apiece, trying to find lost pieces of a jet pod, which I guess will let you travel someplace. I didn't pay that much attention to the story. But basically, you travel through these stages, you jump around, and the jet pod pieces tend to be put on, kind of out-of-the-way spots, similar to the stars in Super Mario 64. But instead of the stage ending as soon as you find one star, you have to find, 4 jet pods. So it's kind of this cumulative hunt-and-search approach. And the stages become much more diffuse and spread out as you advance through the game. Sometimes there's, big structures in the stage where you have to figure out how to get to the top. But sometimes you'll see the jet pod scattered off in the distance on some floating island, and you have to figure out how to get there. And it takes a page from Mario for sure, because you can jump on enemies' heads, and sometimes that damages them. And whether it kills them or not, it usually gives you a boost. If you triple jump and you're just ascending now, if you land on an enemy, you can jump again. So kind of learning to make use of the enemies and landing on them, which seems like it should be really challenging in a 3D first-person space. That becomes key to the game, but it just you know, once you get a handle on the way it controls and plays, it becomes really fun and freeing. And I think that really sets it apart from the other games, the other 3D games that you saw early in the PlayStation's life, because you had things, you know, I mentioned Ridge Racer earlier and Toshinden, Fade to Black, Steel Harbinger. Like, these games all feel much more cramped. I mean, Ridge Racer, you're just going around in a circle, basically. Toshinden, you're fighting in an enclosed arena, a ring. Fade to Black is very much about corridors and small rooms and prison cells and, you know, fighting through these little dingy box-like spaces. And Jumping Flash, unlike those games, is open. It's bright. It's airy. It just feels freeing. And, you know, again, I didn't play this game until several years later, but I can see people playing this back in the day and getting the same kind of sense that they did the first time I played Mario 64, which was just like, oh, I can just go wherever and do whatever. I can jump around and, you know, I'll shoot stuff, but it's really just fun to leap into the air. And nothing else in the early days of PlayStation was like that. And certainly you didn't see games this colorful that much in the US, at least. It was very much about like, hey, it's teenager games now. You're going to be 20 soon. You're going to move out of your house. So it's time for you to move out of Nintendo too and get on PlayStation for grownups. But this is not a game for grownups. It is a game for everyone.
So I was playing mostly Genesis games up until we got our PlayStation. And when we got our PlayStation, I think we only had like one or two games for it. So it was a lot of trips to Blockbuster to sort of like pass over until we were able to get our next game. And Jumping Flash was like this one game that I knew my older brother also liked and I liked. So, you know, we'd be like hunting for games and getting into arguments and our parents being like, it's time to go. We need to get something or you leave with nothing. And then it was like, all right, fine. Just grab Jumping Flash. so there was like lots of times that game, we made rotations through it. But going from the kind of like platforming games that we were playing on Genesis, going to this just open 3D, bright, beautiful, colored world of like full movement and freedom that at the time didn't feel awkward moving around, because like 3D platforming wasn't defined, like you said, until, you know, Mario 64 really was like, oh, everyone, we want to do that. Everyone was kind of figuring out and doing their own thing. So this wasn't that weird trying of how do we make this first person movement work on, a controller, which is clearly not meant for it. It is a little frustrating when you look at the control scheme and there's like six unused buttons in this game. And it's just like, you guys could have,
you could have let us,
you could have done more, but the restriction is almost part of like the challenge. And for me, it was like, once I got through that first like challenge level where you're trying to like collect all of the, it's like one of the bonus levels. That was once I really figured out like the movement of like, oh, you know, you don't need to turn to jump onto that box to the right of you. You can stay facing forward and just jump and like shift vertical or shift horizontally in the air and land on it. And then getting that movement so that you aren't constantly having to like turn and face where you're moving. And then, you start to get like a lot more nimble. Which is required for when you're moving through these really tall sections that you get to later in the game, where the platforming gets pretty intense.
Oh yeah, the platforming. I mean, I really like how they handle the jumping in this. You know, it's really kind of smooth and floaty and relaxing, but there's always been something about it that gives me the willies, for lack of a better term, because when you miss a jump, you know, you float down really slowly and it lets you see, you know, you're looking down and you can contemplate just how you're going to miss it. So it almost gives me like a little fear of heights or something like that, just because of the way you can gauge the distance. And then when you truly miss it, Robert just, you know, he falls really rapidly and there's something, either he's screaming or his little onboard navigator is screaming. And there's something about that that just kind of, I guess I have a fear of heights and I never really knew it.
This is definitely a vertiginous game.
Yes, very good way to put it.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of those. Like the double jump does work a little differently than like a lot of other games. Like if you're, you know, it's definitely not like a Metroidvania double jump where you can jump at any point in. There's a very limited window. You have to like still be going up to enact like a second one of the jumps. Once you start falling, you know that's it. You can only glide from there, which. We'll get the second game makes that a lot clearer than the first game. The first game, a lot of times, you know, without understanding how that works, you're just like, why didn't I jump again? Why didn't I jump again? And then, you know, yeah, you have these like perilous moments of just like, do I keep trying to like go towards that platform that I was going towards, even though I didn't get as high enough air, or do I pivot and just like panic back to like this, the big platform that's like that I caught from and, you know, try to stay alive and glide back down to that and try again.
Yeah, that's me panicking, basically. Yeah. Turn back and then missing that too, and poor Robert just disappears into the stratosphere or whatever.
But, you know, to this game's credit, one of the things that makes it really great and really playable is the fact that when you are sailing through the air, you can tell if you're going to land on something or if you're going to miss it, because the camera does automatically sort of pivot down, and the higher you jump, the further down it pivots. And basically what it's doing is it's locking on to Robert's shadow, which, you know, regardless of where the light source is, Robert's shadow is always directly beneath him. Like, it throws out realistic physics and lighting effects in favor of playability and communicating basic information, essential information, to the player. So you go sailing up into the air, and you can see this little shadowy spot moving around beneath you. And when that shadowy spot is over a little floating island, a tiny rock in the sky, then you know, like, okay, I'm good. I don't want to push forward any further. I don't want to back off or whatever. I just want to keep following this trajectory, and I'm going to land where I want to be. And when you don't see that shadow, you know, well, I blew it. And now it's time to figure out if it's possible for me to save my bacon.
Yeah.
Rabbit bacon, yes.
And it's just such a great intuitive design concept. And it's so surprising that you see it so rarely in 3D games, you know, action games like this, first person games. But it just wasn't a thing for whatever reason. I guess, you know, the idea of taking over the player's perspective and forcing them to look in a direction is sort of an anathema to game designers. They want to, you know, either have a very guided experience or a totally open experience, a totally free experience under the player's control. Now, this is somewhere in between where you have a lot of freedom, but also the game nudges you and it pushes you and it sort of automatically does some things for you just as a quality of life feature. And it walks a really fine balance that I think is very impressive, honestly, considering this is such an early 3D game. And, you know, this was really just the company's second 3D game. And they tried the same basic thing, but, you know, like to nail it so early on is that's great.
They give a lot of credit, I think, also to the player. And sometimes, I mean, it's a little bit of a balance, right? Because when you're on the ground and stuff, they let you kind of free look. And then once you're in the air, it's a lot more like sort of controlled and fixed. Geograph Seal was a bit different in that if you held both buttons, you could actually like aim also while in the air, so you could like aim back up and down, which obviously was needed more because that was way more like combat focused or whatever. But just thinking about like how well they did with like the concept of cameras in these early 3D games, when for the most part people were, like you said, either not trying them, or you look at like Mario 64 where they were like, we're going to give people camera controls and we're so afraid about that we have to make like a literal character holding a camera and like telling them like, you're moving me around so you can see what's happening, rather than being like, move the camera around, which is just completely, you know, second nature to people these days. But yeah, so it does this nice balancing of like letting people look around when they need to, so that you can view around the stage and stuff like that. But in these sort of high intensity moments, it's like, no, we got you. You're going to look exactly where you need to. Don't even worry about it. We've got you covered, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very nice balance.
how do you feel about the Doom stages, the ones that are actual quarter shooters? This game throws out the on-rails space shooting sequences altogether, but it does keep the tunnels and maze sections.
I think it takes away everything that's fun about this game. The best parts of this game are, yeah, when you're it's like the platforming and flying around, and they're like, the whole game is built around this character's verticality, and then they're like, here, go in this section where everything looks exactly the same. I think the first one I like soft locked it because I like missed one of the first jet pods and like kept going down, and then I was like, I don't know how to get back up to get this one I missed, because it's like not, it's just this like little cavern I can't figure it. I just had to restart. I did not have fun on those levels.
I feel like you play through them as opposed to play them.
You endure them, basically.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And how about the boss battles?
I mean for a game that's not combat focused, the combat and the boss battles are like way better than they have like any right to be. I think that's largely from like the character design, which it's so weird because like the game has a plot, kind of. There's just, you know, Baron Aloha wants his resort, so he's stealing a bunch of chunks of land to build a resort, and I guess he has all of these fantastical like robots and machines and creatures or whatever helping him with his bidding that they don't talk about at all. But the character design on these bosses is insane, and there's just no conversation or mention of them whatsoever. You're just like dumped into them, you blow them up, and then they're gone, never to be seen again. It's weird.
Yeah, it's really a nice surprise. Sorry, go ahead. No, I was going to say it's really a nice surprise considering that the rest of the game, they're really unexpected in terms of the design and everything. Sorry, go ahead, Jeremy.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, the bosses in this one don't really stand out to me. Whereas the ones in Jumping Flash 2 are much more memorable, I think, just because they're so visually interesting. There's some really creative designs for the bosses that really stick in my memory.
I might be conflating bosses from 2 with 1, but...
Does 2 have the evil robot, or is that 1? The one that's like him, but the off-color one?
I think that's 2.
That might be 2.
And 2 has the shark with missiles on its back, and that's just great.
I specifically noted the clowns and like the genie in coffee cups was a favorite of mine.
So... any other thoughts on the first Jumping Flash?
I guess we should mention the Izakaya scenes, just at least in their existence, and the moves and sort of... Yeah, I mean, so like, yeah, so I guess the general plot is, yeah, he's Baron Aloha and his like Moo army or whatever, which are these creatures from his planet, I think. Got them working to steal all this stuff to make his thing. And there's these like interstitials every so often of like the moves at an izakaya, like after work drinking, which as a kid, I was just like, I have no idea what's going on here.
Right.
And they also, yeah, they censored the beverages, obviously, I think to like some sort of fruit beverage or something like that, obviously. But yeah, going back to them, it's like very funny now seeing just like imagining these like Moo creatures, you know, after their like 12-hour work day going to the izakaya to like drink off their stress.
Did you see that thing that jumped on my head over and over again? Pour me another Kirin.
Yeah.
One thing about Jumping Flash is I do feel it sort of missed its chance to be a sort of standard bearer for the early PlayStation, because one thing that the whole advent of CDs and systems like the PlayStation Saturn did away with was the need for a pack-in game, you know, something that showed off the system. And you know, the past generation had been an action platformer most of the time, you know, Sonic and Mario and Keith Courage, Altered Beast, what have you. So if Sony had really decided to stick with that whole tradition, I really think Jumping Flash would have been the best thing to put with the PlayStation.
I wonder if they would have done that, or if they would have put Ridge Racer, since it was such a, like, I mean, that wasn't a first-party title, but still, yeah. Like, they pushed that so hard. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the Ridge Racer was a pack and was like an optional thing, kind of like how Virtua Fighter was for the Saturn. Mm. But you know, you didn't really have that whole communal feel where everyone who got the system had this game.
Yeah, everyone played Super Mario Brothers or Super Mario World, but not so much here.
Yeah, they didn't really name their like mascot until Crash came out, which was a couple or 1 year later, I guess.
Yeah, it was late 96.
Yeah, they tried a few different things. I think early on in Japan, they tried Crime Crackers characters and the kid from Motor Tune Grand Prix. And then in America, they had, was it Polygon Man and Sophia from Battle Arena? Nothing really stuck, huh?
I recall Sony Japan also didn't like Crash. Is that? I can't remember. I think they were like against him as a mascot, or maybe
I remember they redesigned him for the first game just to make him look a little cuter, maybe.
Well, that that's a.
I wouldn't say cuter, just like weirder.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah.
The Japanese version of Crash is just kind of like bug-eyed and strange. I don't know. Like, I think eventually Sony realized we don't need a mascot character. We can just sell like great games with great characters, but we don't need like a character who is, you know, the face of our system out there mugging all the time. So that was kind of a helpful breakthrough for console gaming to not necessarily be tied to a cartoon character.
You don't think Gex helped push the 3DO?
Oh, I mean, it pushed it right off a cliff. Yeah.
Or Bug on the Sega Saturn or
right,
Astyle.
Bug. I mean, it's got an exclamation point at the end of the name, so you know it's important.
Oh, boy.
All right, so Jumping Flash came out. People played it and enjoyed it. It was not necessarily the best-selling system on the platform, but it was good. And so a year later, Sony came out, and Exact came out with a sequel called Jumping Flash 2, which is basically, it's Jumping Flash 2. It's, you know, it's basically more of the same thing, nicer, a little smoother, a little more refined, but it doesn't really add a whole lot to the mix. It's refinement, basically.
Did the Big Trouble in Little Moo, did that? I assume that was an American localization only, or I wonder, is that a literal translation from the Japanese name?
Oh, good question.
I do not know.
I'm looking at the Japanese name now. Jumping Furashutsu Aroha Danshaku o Wawari no Maki. No, I don't think
so. It's like Baron Aloha's dangerous thing. Yeah. Okay.
No, something different. Yeah. Jumping Flash 2 is basically Jumping Flash with there's like bits of polish here that I think make the game more accessible and a bit easier to play. They add like the jump meter so that you can see if you still have the ability of activating another jump. They add like that squeaky wheel sound when you're going backwards and reversed. It indicates that you're turning faster or whatever. it's the most distracting sound.
It's better than a backup beeper.
Yeah. It was the most as soon as I did it the first time, I was like, this is the most like generic stock squeaky wheel sound I've ever heard, and I can't not like
That was kind of a thing for these early 3D games though, was just like The sound mix was always a little weird, and
he's
there would
bipedal,
be like
though.
Sound effects that were just like, "What's that?
Isn't he bipedal? Like, where is the squeaky wheel sound coming from? He has
gears?
Feet.
I mean, it's
his
no,
leg
it's just
joints,
like
maybe.
It's just like one of the things that sticks with me with, you know, a lot of PS1 action games is that there is this kind of like disjointedness to the sound stage, and things don't quite all fit together. So to me, that's just emblematic of that kind of style of game, that era. Anyway, I one of the things I think is improved quite a bit in Jumping Flash 2 are the very few Doom style stages. They are at least more visually interesting, and they don't feel quite so dreary, which is a good improvement.
Yeah, in Jumping Flash 1, I was just like, I don't know where I am anymore. Everything is just a brown wall, and I've completely lost. The 1s and 2 are very, like, outlandish and decorated and very visually appealing. They're still not fun, but, you know, they make their best. To me, to me, I think the best improvement, besides the accessibility stuff, is I felt like they're willing to do a lot more with the levels a lot earlier on. Like, really early on in 2, there's, like, the levels you start off, there's, like, moving platforms and all kinds of, crazier stuff that you wouldn't see in the first one until, like, pretty late into the game.
Mm-hmm. Like the flying whale.
Yeah, that flying whale. The first I saw that, I was just like, whoa! And it's another, and you can just jump up. Like, you can just jump up to everything. And a lot of those levels get really vertical really early. I felt like they got a lot more creative with the level design and the environments in 2.
Yeah, I don't really have a huge amount to say about this game. I just think it's very well made and a better version of Jumping Flash in most respects. So that's good.
And it definitely feels a little more demanding, I think, especially early on, like you said. And the fans that those weren't in the first game at all, were they?
They were not.
No.
Like the fans are just floating in the middle of nowhere and you have to use them like platforms. Those just struck me as really kind of hard because it's hard to gauge when you're on the fans, updraft or falling out of it. So,
yeah, I do want to just quickly mention the story again, because the manual makes like, so in this one, it starts out with, Baron Aloha is now a victim of another person. Was it Captain Kabuki? I think is the name of the villain in this one, who is essentially trying to do the exact same thing of steal these giant chunks of land, I think for a different purpose this time. And at first, Baron Aloha is a victim to that, and like, Robert is essentially like dispatched to help him because like the manual says this like 4 times. They're like, Baron Aloha pays his taxes, so he gets the benefits of the government. Which is just like, you guys really are really harping on this one point.
Well, you know, that sets him apart from Yoshi, who commits tax evasion.
Right, yeah. So the story goes then that you're starting off helping the guy, but then as soon as like Robert is helping him, he's like, oh, Robert, that guy that screwed me over last time. And then he basically makes a deal with the villain to be like, I hate this rabbit, I don't care what you do anymore, let's just get this like robot rabbit, which in turn turns all of his moves against him, and they have like a little rebellion, if I recall correctly. Again, the story is largely just told through like these weird interstitial cutscenes, which they could do because it was on PlayStation. But
right,
And when Jumping Flash 2 came out, I think it came out almost around the same time as Crash Bandicoot in 1996 in America, that is, and it was right in the middle of that whole three-way war between Mario, Knights, and Crash. And it seemed like a lot of the advertising just favored Crash across the board, and Sony didn't really push Jumping Flash 2 that much.
Yeah, Crash was a much more visually impressive game. It just had the higher resolution, cleaner graphics, and that's what sells. So they put that front and center in ads, and not so much the Jumping Flash, but by God, we love you, Jumping Flash.
I think the character and personality of Crash is probably a bit more, or I don't know if maybe tailored to, but at least in line with the content that American gamers had been used to receiving compared to something like Jumping Flash. Definitely feels something that older gamers would look at and be like, ew, colors.
Also it's kind of unrepentantly weird in its storyline.
Absolutely.
Like it leans into that, and that's not necessarily something American gamers are always comfortable with.
Yeah, I think you, Scott, I think you compared it to maybe even Katamari Damacy, just the way you have these weird giant characters floating in space.
With like the ruffle.
The Captain Kabuki, I was like, it's like a cross of like Galactus and the King of the Cosmos is like the motives and personality of the villain in this.
So I guess the unimpressive performance of Jumping Flash 2 in the US due to Crash and Mario, I assume, is why we didn't get the third game, Rabbit Mondeau, which came out all the way in 1999. Kind of a late release, only available as an import, and import reviews at the time were very lukewarm on it. So I actually passed over this one.
Yeah, I didn't play it. I mean, I wasn't importing a lot or anything at the time. I think the first thing that actually imported was Game Boy Advance games, because that was the easiest thing to do. Or that was the first time where it was like, oh, you can import things without having to potentially destroy your console. So I played it and watched some playthroughs for this, and it at first I was a bit excited because they like dropped the number of special weapons you hold from 3 to 1. So I was like, oh, you know, less combat, more, maybe more movement stuff. And they add in this like ground pound movement, this thing where it's like, you know, Mario's butt slam, I guess, which is probably exactly where it was taken from. But it doesn't really add a lot. It doesn't really do enough to like change things up. They try to introduce a couple of different like objective types into the levels where it's like, you know, you have to get to the end in like under a certain amount of time without collecting things. And then, you know, there's some variety there, but the levels are a lot shorter. And like with PlayStation load times and stuff, you just like, you play like a level for like 1 minute and 30 seconds. And then, you know, you're back to like a loading screen and back to a level select. And, they tried to change it up a bit, but they felt like they went in the wrong direction.
Yeah, that does sound like the opposite of what most players wanted from a 3D action platform game by the late 90s. They really wanted, you know, more space to explore, even in the case of, you know, rare platformers that were, you know, you collected all kinds of things. You still had a lot of empty levels. So making it smaller and making it more mission-based probably detracted a lot from what was popular at the time.
You know, watching videos of this one to kind of catch up on it, the game that came to mind for me was The Misadventures of Tron Bonne, which It does a lot of the same presentation tricks and, you know, uses a lot of the same techniques and gimmicks as that game, you know, with the mission structure, the fact that you're taking everything, your missions from a map. And I feel like this was a game with a very small budget, just like Tron Bonne was a game with a very small budget. And so they kind of repurposed the 3D engine, you know, did some refinements as they could, but they really sort of had to cut back on the glue that holds together, kind of the niceties. You know, Tron Bonne was a spinoff of Mega Man Legends, and Mega Man Legends and its sequel actually had, you know, a lot of voiced 3D animated cutscenes, whereas Tron Bonne is pretty much just like your characters stand in the background while 2D portraits slide in over top of them. And this kind of gives me, not, it's not exactly the same, but it just gives me the same feeling, like they're trying to do Jumping Flash with way less money.
Yeah, it felt like the stakes are, the story is, I think, as far as I could tell, is just that Robert is just like a mercenary now and is just off doing stuff for money. So there's like, yeah, there's no like cohesion for, or like real motivation as far as I can tell. So and there's none of the like characters or goofiness or any of that sort of, like you said, like tying it all together. It feels very disjointed and just kind of like just gameplay, and the gameplay is not, what they did to it, I think, makes it not strong enough to stand on its own.
Now, was this around the time that Exact was sort of getting absorbed into Sugar and Rockets and, you know, Sony's internal teams? Because it does seem like some of the people who worked on the older games sort of sat out Robert Mondo. Like, there's a designer, Hiroyuki Saigusa, who I think went on to work at Square Enix, but he doesn't seem to have done anything on Robert Mondo.
Yeah, I obviously I can't say because I'm not an expert on Exact, but it does seem like this was kind of where the studio was shifting and maybe being absorbed, because after this, you don't really see credits for Exact anymore. I think the next game in the series, if you want to call it that, Pocket Moo Moo, was also, what's it called? Sugar and Rockets.
Yeah. Sugar and Rockets.
Yeah, that was also developed by them. I didn't realize that was the same studio, actually, that it was like one bled into the other.
So one thing that's interesting is Moo Moo, the creatures, is also listed as a developer for Jumping Flash 2. So I'm assuming that's like the Jumping Flash company or whatever. They do have a couple of other credits outside of Jumping Flash games, but like just a handful of things.
Obviously, Japanese only stuff looks like they were just helping out like Koei and Sony on things. So, right. Yeah.
And it seems like Sugar and Rockets wasn't really around too much longer after this. Like, apparently they were just consolidated in this big sort of Sony gathering up and basically went into one of their internal Japan studio teams.
Yeah, it looks like at some point they just sort of stopped being referenced and all of the stuff just sort of refers to it as Sony.
Mm-hmm. Consolidation.
Can't stop it.
Nope. And you can't stop consolidation, but you can stop jumping Flash because after February 1999, was that after or before? Oh, okay. Actually, Robert Mondeux is the last game in the series. It was preceded very slightly by Pocket Moo Moo, released for PlayStation 1, also only in Japan in February of that year. And this one I definitely didn't bother with because it's a Pocket Station thing, and I just said, no.
Now, how was this distributed? Did you get it as part of Robert Mondeux, or did you...
No, it was a separate game. It was a separate release.
So, yeah, okay. I did a little bit of reading and watching about it. So essentially it's like, yeah, there's a disc game, and the disc part of it is essentially you like collect things for your Pocket Station. There's like apps and games that you collect as part of this like the disc portion of the game. And then you can put those on your Pocket Station. But the games are all like, you know, 100-yard dash and like it's all like the most basic like the games you build when you're like learning how to program games basically is like what they all are, like Snake and like Arkanoid Clone and things like that. So there's nothing too worthwhile in there, I think, unless you were very into your Pocket Station. I was thinking about it and I was just like, oh, I would have hated this at the time. But then I looked at it and it was also exactly when Tamagotchis came out, and I was, you know, I was the perfect age for those and had one of them. But that offered a very specific experience, and I don't think I would have like played games on. I had a Game Boy Color that I played games on. I didn't need a LCD screen like that to try to play on.
Well, for those who don't know what a Pocket Station is, which I have to assume is some of our listeners, that was Sony's answer to Dreamcast's VMU. Basically, the VMU was announced and shown off, and Sony was like, oh, we can't let someone innovate ahead of us. So they grafted an LCD Pocket mini micro game, like, you know, Pokemon Micro. What was it called? Pokemon Mini? That exact same Tamagotchi. They grafted that onto a memory card. And a bunch of games that came out in 1990, 2000 had Pocket Station functionality, which was always superfluous. I want to say the only game that came out in the US that still had Pocket Station functionality attached was Final Fantasy VIII. The Chocobo minigames, if you had a Pocket Station, you could play those. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe like Ridge Racer Type 4? I can't remember, but...
I know that I think even the American manual of Final Fantasy VIII makes reference to the Pocket Station, because it was still planning on being released here when that was printed, and then it was never released here. But
nothing of value was lost.
Yeah. Oh, boohoo.
I had a Pocket Station, and, you know, I downloaded some games from Final Fantasy VIII, the Mega Man collections, and a few others, and every time I was just like, I don't need this.
Yeah, I mean, I had a VMU for my Dreamcast. I don't think I ever actually put anything on it. I think the most fun I ever had on the VMU was, like, when I was playing Virtua Tennis, being like, oh, look, it's doing the same thing on the VMU. And then, like, that was kind of the end of my excitement.
Now, didn't the Misadventures of Tron Bonne have some Pocket Station support?
Oh, yeah,
in Japan,
yeah, it did. But... yeah, there was all kinds of weird peripheral stuff for that. There was also, I have a PlayStation, like, guide or something, like a catalog of games. And it has a disc on it where if you load something onto your memory card from that disc and then play The Misadventures of Tron Bonne with that save information, it gives you a 41st serve bot for Gesellschaft. But that's only available for the Japanese version. So they did some kind of weird, like, peripheral type stuff for that game that didn't, you know, move the needle on it any. But it's neat, I guess. Anyway, the Pocket Station stuff... very much a slice of time that is totally unnecessary now. But, you know, the only company that I think really pulled it off was Sega, just because they said, hey, this is part of our Dreamcast from day one. We're just going to have VMU support all over the place. And even then, still wasn't great.
Yeah. Until the batteries die and, you know, it, yeah, you right? have to listen to it beep every time you turn.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So let's turn on the Dreamcast.
Yeah. Also enter your date again.
Oh, I love that. Love that. Takes me back to the Saturn, but it's more annoying now. All right. So anyway, that's the Jumping Flash series. But this episode is not done, because even though Jumping Flash consisted of three games and a spinoff, Exact made one more game, very much in the spirit of Jumping Flash, though different, even more different from Jumping Flash than Geograph Seal, which was actually my introduction to Exact and this whole kind of oeuvre of games they were making. And that was Ghost in the Shell for PlayStation, which came out in 1997. And let me take you back in the Wayback Machine to 1997, the year before Ghost in the Shell had arrived in the US as a movie that critics loved. Robert Ebert was crazy about it. It was a very pretentious, sort of slow-paced, extremely violent, very philosophical Japanese cartoon. Lots of blood, lots of people's skulls being shot to pieces, lots of boobies. This was not your father's cartoons, kids. But yeah, Ghost in the Shell, directed by Mamoru Oshii, was a very sort of, you know, one of those games that, or one of those films that really, that put moved the needle for anime in America and made people say, whoa, this is different and cool. I got a lot of push, a lot of hype. And so it was fairly big, you know, around the same time Dark Horse was publishing the manga collections. I think they'd actually completed the manga the year before. And so there was just this kind of like Ghost in the Shell. It's, you know, of the times. And then the official PlayStation magazine launches at the end of 2000 or 1997. And lo and behold, on the cover, it's a silver cover. And the only art on it is Major Motoko Kusanagi of Ghost in the Shell, wearing her like skin tight bodysuit, bound up with wires and machines and stuff. Very like bondage kink, but also just innocent enough that you could, you know, read it in polite company. And, you know, OPM's big selling point was that it came with demo discs sanctioned by Sony. And what was on the demo disc? Of course, Ghost in the Shell. So I was like, Ghost in the Shell, a video game on a magazine. That's cool. That's exciting. So I popped it in and it was great and I loved it.
Yeah. And it wasn't too surprising. I mean, looking back, that really was surprising to see that on the cover of a you know, North American magazine, but it made a lot of sense because Ghost in the Shell was possibly more popular in North America than it was in Japan. And it got a big push because THQ was publishing it. It was the first of several games that they published as part of an effort to localize more Japanese titles. And I don't know if any of their other games really got that same kind of attention, because they did Devil Dice, they did Grandstream Saga, they did
Grandstream Saga,
and what was it, G Darius, and then and Quest 64. So they did not localize Japanese games for very long, but they tried, and I think Ghost in the Shell got the biggest push of anything they did.
Well, and also it was super cool. You know, it starts out with that. Now that I go back and rewatch it, extremely kinky and kind of like, whoa, that's spicy. Animated cutscene produced by Production IG. But it has like that driving techno beat to it that it was very much, you know, something that kind of you just heard throughout a lot of PlayStation games like Einhander and, you know, even Tenchu kind of leaned into that occasionally. Wipeout, obviously. So it just felt very like this is, you know, this is the zeitgeist right here. The zeitgeist in the shell, if you will.
And surprisingly, they did not censor that opening, even though...
Yes, they did not.
So, yeah, I was a bit young for Ghost in the Shell when it originally came out, but it was a game that I saw all the time when I was renting Jumping Flash, a game that I was like a kid looking through Blockbuster and being like, what's that girl with all the wires plugged in? Why do I want this game? I can't have this game.
You learned a lot about yourself.
Yeah, I learned a lot about myself very quickly looking at the cover of the Ghost in the Shell game.
And then you read the uncensored Dark Horse manga and was like, whoa, wow, oh my God. Suddenly I'm a man.
I didn't get into
it. The cutscene is very tame compared to the original comic in places.
Yeah, I didn't actually get into Ghost in the Shell until much later. So I actually didn't play the game until this because I wasn't that into it until much later, and then actually did not even really know of the connection that it had with Jumping Flash as into Jumping Flash as I was. So I only played it somewhat recently, and I think not being a huge Ghost in the Shell fan and coming to it way after the fact, I think it's a bit harder to return to, especially because, you know, like I said before, you know, my favorite stuff of the Jumping Flash engine is all about sort of the aerial movement, and this trades the aerial movement for a lot more fast horizontal stuff and shooting, which it
and
does
also,
well.
Also, the ability to cling to any surface,
yeah,
and like skitter around in any direction.
Yeah. So the first time I did that by accident, I was just like, oh God, how do I get off this building? I'm just stuck on this wall now. Yeah, so the movement, yeah, so you can walk forward, you can walk back, and then you can slide to the left, slide to the right, as it's, strafing is not a word in this manual, it specifically says slide to the left, which was just very distracting.
I don't know that strafe was part of the vocabulary yet.
It may not have, well, for PC players, maybe, like, strafing left and right was probably pretty common stance at this point, but yeah, I guess for console gamers, maybe not. But yeah, so the slide movement is very fast, which was kind of hard for me because I was like, I don't want to be walking forward. I just want to do this, like, I just found myself doing this, like, angled slide the whole time, like, facing, like, 45 degrees away from where I wanted to move and then just sliding in that direction because it was faster.
It kind of does the Castlevania Harmony of Dissonance thing where it's faster to get around by dashing. But this time you're dashing at a, you know, perpendicular to the direction you want to move.
Yeah. But the combat was really fun and satisfying. It has this, like the Panzer Dragoon, like, lock-on thing, where, you know, you, like, hold down the thing and you can lock your missiles onto multiple targets. And with how quickly you move, the action gets pretty intense, pretty fast. But just for me, it was... The combat was not what I was looking for in this, and so I kind of got a little tired of it quickly, but... I think if I had played it at the time, it would have been like driving up those walls as fast as you can and jumping off and shooting at helicopters was, you know, that was not anything I could do at the time.
Yeah, I came into 3D gaming. I was one of the weirdos who stuck with the Mac platform throughout the 90s. So what few 3D action games made it to Mac are the ones that I played? So I didn't play Doom. Because they didn't port that to Mac until like 1996 or something. But I did play Marathon, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, this is cool. I played Dark Forces. Mm-hmm. And then I played Descent.
Yes.
And to me, this feels like Descent as a ground-based game. Descent was all about like rotating in, you know, in 360 degrees, moving any direction, reorienting yourself. It was very confusing. And this simplifies that a lot. I mean, you could play Descent on PlayStation, but this takes you out of the air. You're not like a fighter craft. Instead, you are bound to the ground. But you're is it a Tachikoma or Fujikoma in this one? I think it's a Fujikoma.
Yes, I think it's a Fujikoma. Yeah.
I don't know what the difference is. I know that they have both names. But anyway, the Fujikoma, the spider tank, basically, that you control, is... You know, in addition to dashing side to side and shooting missiles and stuff, it has the ability to just climb surfaces. It you know, like you walk up to a wall and you stick to it and you climb up the wall and you can rotate to any angle and, you know, move through space along a wall or along a roof or along a ceiling at that angle. It takes some getting used to, but The Doom style corridor sequences in this game are much more interesting than in Jumping Flash, because those feel, you know, like very stilted, like pre-Doom first person shooter, like Wolfenstein, Faceball 2000, MIDI maze, that kind of thing. Whereas here, you're in these tight spaces, but if you want to avoid enemy projectiles, you dash up the side of the wall and onto the ceiling, and then projectiles are passing beneath you, and you just target the enemy and shoot them, which I think it sounds simpler than it is, because it's very disorienting, and sometimes you stick to the wall when you don't want to, which reviewers complained about a lot. But it's very exciting and very liberating, and it was another one of those games that was like, oh, look at the cool stuff you can do in 3D. And again, you don't see a lot of games do that specific thing, I guess, because it was too confusing. So it's part of that era of game design where people were just like, what can we do with this new technology, this new game design paradigm? And this was one of those things.
So it's funny you mentioned, yeah, so Descent was definitely way more disorienting for me than Descent would give me like legitimate motion sickness when I tried to play it as a kid. This was much more manageable for me. Oh, also, sorry, random thought. Tachi in like Japanese usually means like standing, so I think it's probably with about the orientation of how the person rides in the vehicle. But
okay,
I'm not 100%
yeah. Now these now you say that makes sense.
Yeah,
because there are some of the like the tanks that they like sit in, and you can see them coming out of the cockpit.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't, the movement is, it's also funny to me because like it almost has like a reverse paradigm shift with Jumping Flash, where Jumping Flash was a first person platformer, which, you know, typically at the time would have been a third person platformer, and then this goes to like a third person shooter, which is like typically would have been first person shooters. So that was always just like a funny thing to me that they kind of went in reverse with it in terms of the focus and the camera viewpoint. But it has still that same sense of movement, but it's just spread out to me like horizontally, as opposed to the Jumping Flash stuff, which is all very straight up and down.
Yeah, for me, I was a big fan of Ghost in the Shell by the time this came out. So, you know, I was right there to check this game out, and I really loved it. I just liked the movement and the way you could just slide over basically the entire stage. I remember when I first played it, the first stage, I just wasted so much time just sliding all over the place and getting to grips with the controls. And, you know, as a fan of the property, I thought it was pretty neat that they had the voice work was done by the same people who dubbed the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's really the closest, even today, that any animation has come to looking like the original Ghost in the Shell manga.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's much more about Masamune Shiro's manga than it is the anime by Oshii or, you know, any of the subsequent spinoffs. Like, the characters look the same, but not only that, they have the same expressions. Like, you know, Shiro has a very specific way of drawing like perturbed characters, like the movement of their mouth and, you know, their expressions and their eyes and everything. And this captures that in animation, which is really cool.
And I was impressed to find when I found out it was actually Toshihiro Kawamoto who did the character designs, because he did a really good job of imitating Masamune Shiro's manga. You wouldn't really know it was the Cowboy Bebop guy just from looking at the cutscenes.
But the mechs are cool, so...
Yeah.
Oh. So you have that. This does a great job of recreating some of the iconic mech designs of the manga and the anime in 3D and polygons, like the Think Tank and, you know, the Fuchikomas themselves. They just look authentic. Like, it really has that feel to it. It's very impressive.
And they do make you play. You're not playing as any of the major characters from the manga. You're playing as this rookie who you never really see. You don't even see his face. And I think that helps in a way, just because it makes you more comfortable with never really getting out of the tank. You're basically inside the Fuchikoma for the whole game. So you never really start to wonder, well, why am I not playing Beto or Motoko?
So I actually wanted to ask you, Todd, about this as being a fan of it, because like that's always like one, you know, one of the things about playing a, like a game or something that you're a fan of the franchise of, it's easier like the fantasy of being able to like insert yourself into the story or being able to like play as one of your favorite characters or whatever. That second one is always, you know, risky of, but the first one of like, I feel like they usually have to make you feel like this person that you're supposed to be pretending as, is like blank enough that you can project onto it, but not so blank that they seem completely inconsequential to the story. And I, it felt like this was just, yeah, the like constant, rookie, just like only a constant just addresses always directly as rookie, and you never, yeah, it's, it always that, feels.
I feel like that actually ties back into the manga a lot because what Togusa is the rookie throughout the manga, and they're always referring to him as a rookie, like especially Batou. So, you know, this is like now he's no longer the low guy on the totem pole. Like there's someone beneath him that he can sneer at.
Right, and that may have been a little easier to handle in the original Japanese, where you can basically refer to somebody by their position or their nickname or something like that. And I guess whenever I think of a character who's, you know, kind of completely blank and faceless, I think of kind of like a dating simulator, where the idea is to project yourself, but that really doesn't happen in this game, of course. And I guess, I mean, if they had let you just play as the tank, you know, the cute little tank that's really heavily armed, you would have to acknowledge that the tank is, you know, going around killing people and blowing things up, which it might have been a little hard to swallow.
The one problem I have with them, like, you being in the tank the whole time is at the end, like, I mean, spoiler or whatever, but at the end, they're like, you're too reliant on that tank. And it's just like, oh, what the hell? Like, you guys, I didn't have a choice in that. Like,
so you just, you have to get out of Sophia 3 and blow up the frog yourself.
Right, yeah.
And in that, I think one of the things that makes me like this game so much is the way Exact kind of played to their strengths of themselves as developers and also the PlayStation itself. Because if they had tried to, you know, give sequences where you got out of the tank and walked around like, you know, Blaster Master, it would not have really worked so well. Simply because of the way a 3D, you know, humanoid-based 3D action games generally went on the PlayStation.
Yeah, it, I mean, you're looking at some like Siphon Filter or whatever. Does not this like the tank combat feels way more fun than like trying to run around and shoot stuff in like Siphon Filter.
Yeah, I think that the tank combat, you know, in terms of more modern analogs, reminds me maybe of Vanquish, or yeah, maybe Lost Planet almost. You know, where you're doing a lot of dashing and skating about, and it's pretty quick. So it kind of like predicts that style of game. And
Titanfall, yeah, I think, also.
What's that?
Have you played Titanfall?
I have not, but I believe you when you say that.
Oh, it's just a lot of that. Like, well, there's a lot of mech stuff in that too, but there's a lot of like parkour and jumping and grappling and flying around and stuff like that. So,
yeah. So I think it really kind of hits on that. And I can think of a few other games that I've played. I know I've played other games where you play as kind of like the faceless rookie, and it's just kind of played at face value. I think, what was it called? The Silver Case is like that, where you don't play as like a named character. You just play as the rookie, and your character does eventually kind of get some backstory and development, but you're always just kind of like this faceless rookie. And that's, you know, that is very much a like kind of place yourself in this world. But I think it was an okay approach. Yeah, Dragon Quest.
Yeah.
I did kind of expect even a twist at the end, considering how your character doesn't have a name, for them to maybe say, oh, you're just an android or something like that. Or
a simulation, a ghost. Yeah,
that was one thing that I was like, the plot of, and so, you know, I do caveat this, that my really only experience with like the Ghost in the Shell universe is this game and the movie, but it did, the plot of this does seem like a lot less like out there and... The plot of the movie is, I don't want to, if anyone hasn't seen it or whatever, but just like, you know,
it's fine. It's 25 years old.
But yeah, I mean, you know, like the idea of like two competing personalities in living inside a single android and like what that means and life and all this stuff. And this is like, there's a terrorist attack, but it's not really a terrorist attack. It was planned to extort some people for money. And you're like, well, that's
kind of boring, like the other scenarios.
It really does the anti-terrorist police procedural part of the manga. That's kind of what it captures. It reminds me a little bit of Ghost in the Shell 1.5, which is kind of like came after the original manga. That's really just police stories.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it feels like a simplified take on the universe for sure. But, you know, I think to kind of keep things going with the video game, they sort of had to do that because Ghost in the Shell involves some shooty parts and, you know, skulls exploding and stuff. But a lot of it is more like, you know, gazing at navels and contemplating one's place in reality. And, whoa, there's a robot lady who looks just like my robot lady body. What does that mean for me? Am I unique? You know, so it's more about like pensive, ponderous questions. You have to just kind of strip that down to make an action game out of it. And I feel like, I don't know, I've played a few other Ghost in the Shell games. And to me, this is still the most interesting because it's just pure, you know, like, here are the tanks that you saw much more in the comics than in the movie, and you're just sliding around, shooting stuff, jumping on ceilings, sniping dudes from the rooftop, and you get to the rooftop by climbing up the side of a skyscraper. Like, it's great.
Yeah, and you can compare it to the PSP Ghost in the Shell standalone complex game where you're in a Tachikoma for some of the time, and it's just doesn't work nearly as well.
I'll also say, yeah, I mean, compared to the other... The typical caliber of like any licensed property game on the PlayStation era of this time, like this far out seeds, both in terms of like presenting the player with actually something interesting about the universe and also having like some actual fun gameplay in there, compared to, you know, God, I mean, like Independence. Oh, I mean, that's just the first thing that popped into my head of a game of that era, but good God, what a miserable experience.
And that was what kind of made this game neat back in 1997, because today we kind of assume in anime-based games, they're just another part of any release schedule. But, you know, back in the late 90s, it was actually quite a surprise to see an anime-based game sitting right there on the shelf at Blockbuster or Electronics Boutique. You know, go ahead.
Oh, so yeah, outside of like Dragon Ball Z, like I don't think I remember seeing really any anime-based games making it stateside or having any sort of prominence in that area or in that era.
Well, there was Ranma 1/2.
Yeah. And the majority of them, you had to basically mail order them out of the back of a magazine and hope that they weren't terrible. And so you got to rent this one and play the demo disc instead. So.
Yeah, so, you know, if nothing else, Exact helped bring anime to America and make us nerds even nerdier. So good on them for that. But yeah, it's a shame that we don't see... I mean, it's been more than 20 years since Exact made a game, I guess since they existed, and it's been more than 20 years since we've seen a game made by Sony in that style, unless you count Gravity Rush, which, yeah. So, you know, it's very much, you know, a slice of the PlayStation era. There's this little 4 or 5 year window where this company was doing cool stuff in a certain style. And I guess the games industry moved on and, you know, that style, maybe it's not so necessary anymore, but I don't know. I feel like maybe in the indie space, there's room for a game developer to say, hey, let's rip off Jumping Flash and make a modern one and do it with better graphics.
Man. So, it's even kind of sad to think of what Jumping Flash 3, you know, an actual Jumping Flash 3 might have been like if they'd been able to mix, you know, the original game's jumping mechanics with the maybe even the Ghost in the Shell idea where you can cling to any surface and scoot up the side of buildings.
Twin stick controls.
Yeah, and on the PlayStation 2 even, where you could have done much bigger levels and things like that. So there's so much potential.
Let's give it to what's the name of the studio? I just totally Sucker Punch. And have them make like a, you know, kind of take the Ratchet and Clank engine. Was that Sucker Punch? No, that was Insomniac.
That's Insomniac.
I mean, like take the Spider-Man Ratchet and Clank engines and give us a new Jumping Flash and make it, you know, more of an open world with just like really imaginative spaces, lots of chasms and gulfs and floating islands and stuff. But instead of being contained to tiny little spaces, it's this big world where you can just jump around. You know, Crackdown did that. But they're not making Crackdown games anymore either. So it's time. Bring back Jumping Flash. Let us leap by bounds, by many bounds. You know, they're not even making Metroid Prime games. Metroid Prime is what ripped off Jumping Flash. And they've been talking about Metroid Prime 4 for years and still nothing. So it's time. Bring back Jumping Flash, Sony, you cowards.
And they don't really acknowledge Jumping Flash outside of, you know, the re-releasing it, the earlier games, do they? I mean, it's not like Nintendo where they'll bury obscure characters as Smash Brothers trophies or something like that. But
I mean, there could be trophies in PlayStation All-Stars Brawl or whatever, and I would never know because I'm not playing that game.
Yeah. And what was that? That tech demo that came out with the Astro's Playroom or whatever.
Yeah, that could have been Robert's
Playroom. Probably some Jumping Flash stuff in there or whatever, but yeah.
I think actually there's been, I think, like a resurgence of first-person platformers somewhat in the indie scene that I've seen some games come out recently. There's a couple of, like, that come to mind specifically. Was it, like, Neon White that just came out? That's, like, it's presented as, like, a card-based first-person shooter, but it's actually really the sort of, like, you're presented with this platforming level, and there's really sort of, like, an easy way to get through it and a hard way to get through it, and there's, like, these complicated platforming segments that you sort of need to figure out and practice and learn upon. But it has this great sense of movement and a lot of, like, horizontal and aerial movement, and to me it was, like, I played it just sort of very coincidentally right before I got back into playing Jumping Flash for this. And I was just like, oh, there's like a kind of a through line here of like this generation of first person platformers that have come out over the past couple of years. And then there was this other game sort of on the more abstract side that came out a couple of years ago, XO1. It's this game where you're like this orb that can like turn flat. And it's basically all about just traversal, but you basically like go through these dips and launch yourself really, really, really high into the air over these just very vast, humongous areas of ground. And it's just very satisfying to sort of like see how high you can get and how far you can go as the ground's like changing below you. There's just a couple of things like that that sort of made me think back to the freedom of movement and whatnot that you felt, like you first feel when you just get that first like huge triple jump off of something and Jumping Flash.
Yeah, I haven't played XO1, but I'm looking at screenshots and artwork, and yes, it's definitely got that vibe to it. All right, well, that's Jumping Flash and its legacy, and also Ghost in the Shell. So thanks, both of you, for taking your time to talk about these games with me today. Scott, thank you, especially for supporting Retronauts and being a patron and making this request, because it finally motivated me to make an episode about Jumping Flash, which is long overdue. So thank you for that. So we'll end this episode by letting you share your bona fides online. Where can people find you on the internet? If there's anything you're doing online, creating... If there's not, that's okay too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm online. I deleted my Twitter profile out of frustration and mental health a while ago, but then sort of succumbed and recreated it. So yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Scott Rothman, and just, you know, watch me tweet angrily at politicians and things like that. If
good,
that's
good
sort of up here.
These days.
Yeah, it doesn't. No, it's, I really should stop.
All right, Todd, what about you?
Well, I'm on Twitter as Kid Fenris. It's also the name of a little website, sort of a ancient blog that I update about once a month. But I also do with a friend this video series called Unsung Game Creators, where we try to spotlight developers exactly like Exact that never quite either got the chance to do something great, or they maybe or have been forgotten. So yeah, check us out.
All right, and you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite, on Retronauts as Jeremy Parrish, on YouTube, and at Limited Run Games. I'm doing a lot of stuff. I'm out there. You can find me. I'm publishing books. There aren't any in print right now, but soon, soon. And of course, Retronauts, you can find at retronauts.com. You can find on the HyperX Podcast Network. You can find on pretty much any podcatcher you like. And every Monday we publish an episode, And if you are a patron supporting us at patreon.com/retronauts, you can listen to that Monday episode a week ahead of everyone else with a higher bitrate quality, good audio quality, and no advertisements or promotions. So please consider supporting us at patreon.com/retronauts. And there are different tiers you can support us at. If you support at the $5 tier each month, then you can get exclusive episodes only for patrons every other Friday, exclusive weekly columns, Discord access, etc. And then, of course, there are the higher tiers, such as the ones Scott supports us at, where you get to make episode requests or even be on an episode. So once again, that's the pitch, patreon.com/retronauts. It's, video games. I tell you what, they keep getting older, and so do we, so we're going to keep talking about them. Anyway, thanks again, Scott and Todd, for talking about an old video game that needs to make a comeback. That's the law now.
That's right.
I'm demanding, I'm mandating it. So let's look forward to Jumping Flash 3 in the year 2023. That's my promise to you. Sony needs to do that. I'm making the promise for them. All right. Thanks again, guys.